webbed wakes of the grass serpents, he could not be sure they were not resting in wait below. He wondered idly where the wind wagon had gone. The thing had been fully automated and presumably programmed by the Church of the Shrike, since they had sponsored the pilgrimage. What other duties might the thing have had? The consul shook his head, sat upright, and pinched his cheeks. He had been drifting in and out of dreams, even as he thought about the wind wagon. 15 hours had seemed a short enough time as he stood talking about it in the Valley of the Time Tombs. He glanced at his comm log. 5 hours had passed. The consul lifted the mat to 200 meters, looked carefully for any sign of a serpent, and then brought the mat down to a hover 5 meters above the grass. Carefully, he extracted the rope, made a loop, moved to the front of the carpet, and wound several lengths around the carpet, leaving enough slack to slide his body in before tightening the knot. If the mat fell, the tether would be worse than useless, but the snug bands of rope against his back gave a sense of security as he leaned forward to tap the flight designs again, leveled the carpet out at 40 meters, and laid his cheek against the warm fabric. Sunlight filtered through his fingers, and he realized that his bare forearms were getting a terrible sunburn. He was too tired to sit up and roll down his sleeves. A breeze came up. The consul could hear a rustling and sliding below as either the grasses blew or something large slithered past. He was too tired to care. The consul closed his eyes and was asleep in less than 30 seconds. The consul dreamed of his home, his true home on Maui Covenant, and the dream was filled with color. The bottomless blue sky, the wide expanse of the South Sea, ultramarine fading to green where the equatorial shallows began, the startling greens and yellows and orchid reds of the Motil Islands as they were herded north by the dolphins, extinct now since the hegemony invasion in the consul's childhood, but quite alive in his dream, breaking the water in great leaps that sent 1,000 prisms of light dancing in the pure air. In his dream, the consul was a child again, and he stood on the highest level of a treehouse on their first family isle. Grandmother Siri was next to him, not the regal grande dame he had known, but the beautiful young woman his grandfather had met and fallen in love with. The tree sails were flapping as the southerlies came up, moving the herd of Motil Isles in precise formation through the blue channels through the shallows. Just on the northern horizon, he could see the first of the equatorial archipelago islands rising green and permanent against an evening sky. Siri touched his shoulder and pointed to the west. The isles were burning, sinking, their keel roots writhing in purposeless pain. The consul recognized billion-volt lances as they fried the air and left blue-gray after-images on his retinas. Underwater explosions lighted the oceans and sent thousands of fish and fragile sea creatures bobbing to the surface in their death throes. "Why?" asked Grandmother Siri, but her voice was the soft whisper of a teenager. The consul tried to answer her but could not. Tears blinded him. He reached for her hand, but she was no longer there, and the sense that she was gone, that he could never make up for his sins, hurt him so badly that he found it impossible to breathe. His throat was clogged with emotion. Then he realized that it was smoke that burned his eyes and filled his lungs. The family isle was on fire. The child who was the consul staggered forward in the blue-black darkness, hunting blindly for someone to hold his hand, to reassure him. A hand closed on his. It was not Ceres. The hand was impossibly firm as it squeezed. The fingers were blades. The consul came awake gasping. It was dark. He had slept for at least 7 hours. Struggling with the ropes, he sat up, stared at his glowing comm log display. 12 hours. He had slept for 12 hours. Every muscle in his body ached as he leaned over and peered below. The hawking mat held a steady altitude of 40 meters, but he had no idea where he was. Low hills rose and fell below. The mat must have cleared some by only 2 or 3 meters. Orange grass and shrub lichen grew in spongy tufts. Somewhere, sometime in the past few hours, he had passed over the south shore of the sea of grass, missed the small port of Edge and the Hooli River docks where their levitation barge, Benares, had been tied up. The consul had no compass. Compasses were useless on Hyperion, and his comm log had not been programmed as an inertial direction finder. He had planned to find his way back to Keats by following the Hooli south and west, retracing the laborious path of their upriver pilgrimage minus the bends and turns in the river. Now he was lost. The consul set the hawking mat down on a low hilltop, stepped off to solid ground with a groan of pain, and collapsed the mat. He knew that the charge in the flight threads must be at least a third expended by now, perhaps more. He had no idea how much efficiency the mat lost with age. The hills looked like the rough country southwest of the Sea of Grass, but there was no sight of the river. His comm log told him that it had been dark for only an hour or two, but the consul could see no hint of sunset in the west. The skies were overcast, shielding both starlight and any space battles from sight. "Damn," whispered the consul. He walked around until circulation returned, urinated at the edge of a small drop-off, and returned to his mat to drink from a water bottle. Think. He had set the mat on a southwesterly course that should have left the Sea of Grass at or near the port city of Edge. If he had simply overflown Edge and the river while he slept, the river would be somewhere to his south, off to his left. But if he had aimed poorly as he left Pilgrim's Rest, been just a few degrees off to his left, then the river would be winding northeast somewhere to his right. Even if he went the wrong way, he eventually would find a landmark, the coast of the northern main, if nothing else. But the delay could cost him a full day. The consul kicked at a rock and folded his arms. The air was very cool after the heat of the day. A shiver made him realize that he was half sick from sunburn. He touched his scalp and pulled his fingers away with a curse. Which way? The wind whistled through low sage and sponge lichen. The consul felt very far removed from the time tombs and the threat of the shrike, but he felt the presence of Saul and Doré and Hetmastine and Braun and the missing Silenus and Kassad as an urgent pressure on his shoulders. The consul had joined the pilgrimage as a final act of nihilism. A pointless suicide, to put an end to his own pain, pain at the loss of even the memory of wife and child, killed during the hegemony's machinations on Brescia, and pain at the knowledge of his terrible betrayal, betrayal of the government he had served for almost 4 decades, betrayal of the ousters who had trusted him. The consul sat on a rock and felt that purposeless self-hatred fade as he thought of Saul and his infant child waiting in the Valley of the Time Tombs. He thought of Braun, that brave woman, energy incarnate, lying helpless with that leech-like extension of the Shrike's evil growing from her skull. He sat, activated the mat, and rose to 800 meters, so close to the ceiling of clouds that he could have raised a hand and touched them. A second's break in the cloud cover far to his left showed a glint of ripple. The Hooli lay about 5 clicks to the south. The consul banked the hawking mat steeply to his left, feeling the tired containment field trying to press him to the carpet, but feeling safer with the ropes still attached. 10 minutes later, he was high over the water, swooping down to ascertain that it was the broad Hooli rather than some tributary. It was the Hooli. Radiant gossamers glowed in the low, marshy areas along the banks. The tall, crenellated towers of architect ants cast ghostly silhouettes against a sky only slightly darker than the land. The consul rose to 20 meters, took a drink of water from his bottle, and headed downriver at full speed. Sunrise found him below the village of Dukobor's copse, almost to the Karla locks where the Royal Transport Canal cut west toward the northern urban settlements and the main. The consul knew that it was less than 150 clicks to the capital from here, but still a maddening 7 hours away at the hawking mat's slow pace. This was the point in the trip where he had hoped to find a military skimmer on patrol, one of the passenger dirigibles from the Copse of Naiad, even a fast powerboat he could commandeer. But there was no sign of life along the banks of the Hooghly, except for the occasional burning building or ghee lamps in distant windows. The docks had been stripped of all boats. The river mantapens above the locks were empty, the great gates open to the current, and no transport barges were lined up below where the river widened to twice its upriver size. The consul swore and flew on. It was a beautiful morning, as the sunrise illuminated the low clouds and made every bush and tree stand out in the low, horizontal light. It felt to the consul as if it had been months since he had seen real vegetation. Weirwood and half-oak trees rose to majestic heights on the distant bluffs, while in the floodplain, the rich light caught the green shoots of a million periscope beans rising from their indigene paddies. Womangrove root and fire fern lined the banks, and each branch and twisting stood out in the sharp light of sunrise. The clouds swallowed the sun. It began to rain. The consul tugged on the battered tricorn, huddled under Kassad's extra cloak, and flew on southward at 100 meters. The consul tried to remember. How long did the child Rachel have? Despite his long sleep the day before, the consul's mind was heavy with fatigue toxins. Rachel had been 4 days old when they had arrived at the valley. That had been 4 days ago. The consul rubbed his cheek, reached for a water bottle, and found them all empty. He could easily dip down and refill the bottles in the river, but he did not want to take the time. His sunburn ached and made him shiver as the rain dripped from his cap. Saul said that as long as I'm back by nightfall, it would be all right. Rachel was born after 2000 hours, translated to Hyperion time. If that's right, if there's no error, she has until 8 tonight. The consul rubbed water from his cheeks and eyebrows. Say 7 more hours to Keats. 1 hour or 2 to liberate the ship. Theo will help. He's governor general now. I can convince him that it's in the hegemony's interest to countervene Gladstone's orders to quarantine the ship. If necessary, I'll tell him that she ordered me to conspire with the ousters to betray the web. Say 10 hours plus the 15-minute flight in the ship. Should be at least 1 hour to spare before sunset. Rachel will be only a few minutes old, but... what? What do we try besides the cryogenic fugue lockers? Nothing. It has to be that. It was always Saul's last chance, despite the doctor's warnings that it might kill the child. But then, what about Braun? The consul was thirsty. He pulled back the cloak, but the rain had lessened to the point that it was a fine drizzle, just enough to wet his lips and tongue to make him more thirsty. He cursed softly and began to descend slowly. Perhaps he could hover over the river just long enough to fill his bottle. The hawking mat quit flying 30 meters above the river. 1 second it was descending gradually, as smooth as a carpet on a gentle glass incline, and the next instant it was tumbling and plummeting out of control, a 2-meter rug and terrified man thrown out of the window of a 10-story building. The consul screamed and tried to jump free, but the rope connecting him to the carpet and the duffel strap tied to his belt tangled him in the flapping mass of hawking mat, and he fell with it, tumbling and twisting, the final 20 meters to the hard surface of the waiting Hooghly River. 29. Saul Weintraub had high hopes the night the consul left. At last, they were doing something. Or trying to. Saul did not believe that the cryogenic vaults of the consul's ship would be the answer to saving Rachel. Medical experts on Renaissance Vector had pointed out the extreme danger of that procedure, but it was good to have an alternative, any alternative. And Saul felt that they had been passive long enough, awaiting the Shrike's pleasure like condemned criminals awaiting a guillotine. The interior of the Sphinx seemed too treacherous this night, and Saul brought their possessions out on the broad granite porch of the tomb, where he and Duray sought to make Mastin and Braun comfortable under blankets and capes, with packs for pillows. Braun's medical monitors continued to show no brain activity whatsoever, while her body rested comfortably. Mastine turned and tossed in the grip of fever.
"What do you think the Templar's problem is?" asked Duray.
"Disease?"
"It could be simple exposure," said Saul. "After being abducted from the wind wagon, he found himself wandering in the barrens and here in the valley of the Time Tombs. He was eating snow for liquid and had no food at all." Duray nodded and checked the force med patch they had attached to the inside of Mastine's arm. The telltale showed the steady drip of intravenous solution.
"But it seems to be something else," said the Jesuit. "Almost a madness."
"Templars have an almost telepathic connection to their tree ships," said Saul. "It must have driven Voice of the Tree Mastine a bit mad when he watched the destruction of the Yggdrasil, especially if he somehow knew it was necessary." Doré nodded and continued sponging the Templar's waxy forehead. It was after midnight, and the wind had come up, moving vermilion dust in lazy spirals and moaning around the wings and rough edges of the Sphinx. The tombs glowed brightly and then dimmed, now one tomb, then the next, in no apparent order or sequence. Occasionally, the tug of time tides would assail both men, making them gasp and grip the stone, but the wave of déjà vu and vertigo would fade after a moment. With Braun Lamia attached to the Sphinx via the cable welded to her skull, they could not leave. Sometime before dawn, the clouds parted and the sky became visible, the thickly clustered stars almost painful in their clarity. For a while, the only signs of the great fleets warring there were the occasional fusion trails, narrow diamond scratches on the pane of night. But then the blossoms of distant explosions began to unfurl again, and within the hour the glow of the tombs had been dimmed by the violence above.
"Who do you think will win?" asked Father Duray.
The two men sat with their backs to the stone wall of the Sphinx, faces raised to the cusp of sky revealed between the tomb's forward curved wings. Saul was rubbing Rachel's back as she slept on her stomach, rear end raised under the thin blankets.
"From what the others say, it seems preordained that the web must suffer a terrible war."
"So you believe the AI Advisory Council's predictions?"
Saul shrugged in the darkness.
"I really know nothing about politics, or the Corps' accuracy in predicting things. I'm a minor scholar from a small college on a backwater world, but I have the feeling that something terrible is in store for us, that some rough beast is slouching toward Bethlehem to be born."
Duray smiled.
"Yeats," he said.
The smile faded.
"I suspect that this place is the new Bethlehem."
He looked down the valley toward the glowing tombs.
"I spent a lifetime teaching about St. Teilhard's theories of evolution toward the Omega Point. Instead of that, we have this. Human folly in the skies. And a terrible Antichrist waiting to inherit the rest."
"You think that the Shrike is the Antichrist?"
Father Duray set his elbows on his raised knees and folded his hands.
"If it's not, we're all in trouble." He laughed bitterly. "It wasn't long ago that I would have been delighted to discover an Antichrist. Even the presence of some anti-divine power would have served to shore up my failing belief in any form of divinity."
"And now?" Saul asked quietly. Duray spread his fingers.
"I, too, have been crucified."
Saul thought of the images from the Nar Hoyt story about Duray. The elderly Jesuit nailing himself to a Tesla tree, suffering the years of pain and rebirth rather than surrender to the cruciform DNA parasite which even now burrowed under the flesh of his chest. Duray lowered his face from the sky.
"There was no welcome from a heavenly father," he said softly. "No reassurance that the pain and sacrifice had been worth anything. Only pain. Pain and darkness. And then pain again."
Saul's hand stopped moving on his infant's back.
"And that made you lose your faith?"
Duray looked at Saul.
"On the contrary, it made me feel that faith is all the more essential. Pain and darkness have been our lot since the fall of man. But there must be some hope that we can rise to a higher level, that consciousness can evolve to a plane more benevolent than its counterpoint of a universe hardwired to indifference. Saul nodded slowly. I had a dream during Rachel's long battle with Merlin's sickness. My wife Sarai had the same dream, that I was being called to sacrifice my only daughter.
Yes, said Duray. I listened to the consul's summary on disk.
Then you know my response, said Saul.
First, that Abraham's path of obedience can no longer be followed, even if there is a God demanding such obedience. Second, that we have offered sacrifices to that God for too many generations, that the payments of pain must stop.
Yet you are here, said Duray,
gesturing toward the valley, the tombs, the night.
I'm here, agreed Saul. But not to grovel, rather to see what response these powers have to my decision. He touched his daughter's back again. Rachel is a day and a half old now, and growing younger each second. If the Shrike is the architect of such cruelty, I want to face him, even if he is your Antichrist. Even if there is a God and he has done this thing, I will show the same contempt to him.
Perhaps we've all shown too much contempt as it is, mused Duray.
Saul looked up, as a dozen pinpoints of fierce light expanded into ripples and shockwaves of plasma explosions far out in space.
I wish we had the technology to fight God on an equal basis, he said in low, tight tones, to beard him in his den, to fight back for all of the injustices heaped on humanity, to allow him to alter his smug arrogance or be blown to hell. Father Duray raised one eyebrow, then smiled slightly.
I know the anger you feel.
The priest gently touched Rachel's head.
Let's try to get some sleep before sunrise, shall we?
Saul nodded, lay next to his child, and pulled the blanket up to his cheek. He heard Duray whispering something that might have been a soft good night, or perhaps a prayer. Saul touched his daughter, closed his eyes, and slept. The Shrike did not come in the night, nor did it come the next morning, as sunlight painted the southwestern cliffs and touched the top of the crystal monolith. Saul awoke as sunlight crept down the valley. He found Duray sleeping next to him, Mastine and Braun still unconscious. Rachel was stirring and fussing. Her cry was that of a hungry newborn. Saul fed her with one of the last nursing packs, pulling the heating tab and waiting a moment for the milk to reach body temperature. Cold had settled in the valley overnight, and frost glinted on the steps to the Sphinx. Rachel ate greedily, making the soft mewling and sucking sounds that Saul remembered from more than 50 years earlier, as Sarai had nursed her. When she finished, Saul burped her and left her on his shoulder, as he rocked gently to and fro. A day and a half left. Saul was very tired. He was growing old, despite the single Poulsen treatment a decade earlier. At the time, he and Sarai would normally have been freed of parental duties, their only child in graduate school and off on an archaeological dig in the outback. Rachel had fallen prey to Merlin's sickness, and parenthood had soon descended upon them once again. The curve of those duties rose as Saul and Sarai grew older, then Saul alone, after the air crash on Barnard's world. And now he was very, very tired. But despite that, despite everything, Saul was interested to note that he did not regret a single day of caring for his daughter. A day and a half left. Father Duray awoke after a bit, and the two men made breakfast from the various canned goods Braun had brought back with her. Het Mastine did not awaken, but Duray applied the next-to-last med pack, and the Templar began receiving fluids and IV nutrient.
Do you think Emlamia should have the last med pack applied? Asked Duray.
Saul sighed and checked her comlog monitors again.
I don't think so, Paul.
According to this, blood sugar is high. Nutrient levels check out as if she had just eaten a decent meal.
But how?
Saul shook his head. Perhaps that damned thing is some sort of umbilical. He gestured toward the cable attached to the point in her skull where the neural shunt socket had been.
So what do we do today?
Saul peered at a sky already fading to the green and lapis dome they had grown used to on Hyperion.
We wait, he said.
Het Mastin awoke in the heat of the day, shortly before the sun reached the zenith. The Templar sat straight up and said,
The tree!
Duray hurried up the steps from where he had been pacing below. Saul lifted Rachel from where she lay in shadow near the wall and moved to Mastin's side. The Templar's eyes were focused on something above the level of the clouds. Saul glanced up but could see only the paling sky.
The tree!
Cried the Templar again and lifted one roughened hand. Duray restrained the man.
He's hallucinating. He thinks he sees the Yggdrasil, his tree ship.
Het Mastin struggled against their hands.
No, not the Yggdrasil,
he gasped through parched lips.
The tree, the final tree, the tree of pain.
Both men looked up then, but the sky was clear except for wisps of clouds blowing in from the southwest. At that moment there was a surge of time tides, and both Saul and the priest bowed their heads in sudden vertigo. It passed. Het Mastin was trying to get to his feet. The Templar's eyes were still focused on something far away. His skin was so hot that it burned Saul's hands.
Get the final med pack, snapped Saul. Program the ultramorph and anti-fever agent.
Duray hurried to comply.
The tree of pain, managed Het Mastin. I was meant to be its voice. The Urg is meant to drive it through space and time. The bishop and the voice of the great tree have chosen me. I cannot fail them.
He strained against Saul's arms a second, then collapsed back to the stone porch.
I am the true chosen, he whispered, energy leaving him like air from an emptying balloon. I must guide the tree of pain during the time of atonement.
He closed his eyes. Duray attached the final med pack, made sure the monitor was set for Templar quirks in metabolism and body chemistry, and triggered the adrenaline and painkillers. Saul huddled over the robed form.
That's not Templar terminology or theology, said Duray. He's using Shrike cult language.
The priest caught Saul's eye.
That explains some of the mystery, especially from Bronzetail. For some reason, the Templars have been in collusion with the Church of the Final Atonement, the Shrike cult.
Saul nodded, slipped his own comlog on Mastin's wrist, and adjusted the monitor.
The Tree of Pain must be the Shrike's fabled Tree of Thorns, muttered Duray,
glancing up at the empty sky where Mastin had been staring.
But what does he mean that he and the Urg were chosen to drive it through space and time? Does he really think he can pilot the Shrike's tree, the way the Templars do the tree ships? Why?
You'll have to ask him in the next life, said Saul tiredly. He's dead. Duray checked the monitors, added Lenar Hoyt's comlog to the array. They tried the MedPak revival stimulants, CPR, and mouth-to-mouth resuscitation. The monitor telltales did not waver. Het Mastin, Templar, true voice of the tree, and Shrike pilgrim, was indeed dead. They waited an hour, suspicious of all things in this perverse valley of the Shrike. But when the monitors began showing rapid decomposition of the corpse, they buried Mastin in a shallow grave 50 meters up the trail toward the entrance to the valley. Cassatt had left behind a collapsible shovel, labeled entrenching tool in force jargon, and the men took turns digging, while the other watched over Rachel and Braunlamia. The two men, one cradling a child, stood in the shadow of a boulder while Duray said a few words before the soil was dropped onto the makeshift fiber-plastic shroud.
I did not truly know M. Mastin, said the priest. We were not of the same faith, but we were of the same profession. Voice of the Tree Mastin spent much of his life doing what he understood to be God's work, pursuing God's will in the writings of the Muir and the beauties of nature. His was the true faith, tested by difficulties, tempered by obedience, and in the end, sealed by sacrifice.
Duray paused and squinted into a sky that had faded to gunmetal glare.
Please accept your servant, O Lord. Welcome him into your arms as you will someday welcome us, your other searchers who have lost their way. In the name of the Father, and of the Son, and of the Holy Spirit. Amen.
Rachel began to cry. Saul walked her around as Duray shoveled the earth onto the man-shaped bundle of fiber plastic. They returned to the porch of the Sphinx and gently moved Braun into what little shade remained. There was no way to shield her from the late afternoon sun unless they carried her into the tomb itself, and neither man wanted to do that.
The consul must be more than halfway to the ship by now,
said the priest after taking a long drink of water. The man's forehead was sunburned and filmed with sweat.
Yes, said Saul. By this time tomorrow, he should be back here. We'll use laser cutters to free Braun, then set her in the ship surgery. Perhaps Rachel's reverse aging can be arrested in cryogenic storage, despite what the doctor said.
Yes.
Duray lowered the water bottle and looked at Saul. Do you believe that is what will happen?
Saul returned the other man's gaze.
No.
Shadows stretched from the southwestern cliff walls. The day's heat coalesced into a solid thing, then dissipated a bit. Clouds moved in from the south. Rachel slept in the shadows near the doorway. Saul walked up to where Paul Duray stood staring down the valley and set a hand on the priest's shoulder.
What are you thinking about, my friend?
Duray did not turn.
I am thinking that if I did not truly believe that suicide was a mortal sin, that I would end things to allow young Hoyt a chance at life.
He looked at Saul and showed a hint of smile.
But is it suicide, when this parasite on my chest, on his chest then, would someday drag me kicking and screaming to my own resurrection?
Would it be a gift to Hoyt? Asked Saul quietly. To bring him back to this?
Duray said nothing for a moment. Then he clasped Saul's upper arm.
I think that I shall take a walk.
Where?
Saul squinted out at the thick heat of the desert afternoon. Even with the low cloud cover, the valley was an oven. The priest made a vague gesture.
Down the valley. I will be back before too long.
Be careful, said Saul. And remember, if the consul runs across a patrol skimmer along the Huli, he might be back as early as this afternoon.
Duray nodded, went over to pick up a water bottle and to touch Rachel gently. And then he went down the long stairway of the Sphinx, picking his way slowly and carefully, like an old, old man. Saul watched him leave, becoming a smaller and smaller figure, distorted by heat waves and distance. Then Saul sighed and went back to sit near his daughter. Paul Duray tried to keep to the shadows, but even there the heat was oppressive, weighing on him like a great yoke on his shoulders. He passed the jade tomb and followed the path toward the northern cliffs and the obelisk. That tomb's thin shadow painted darkness on the roseate stone and dust of the valley floor. Descending again, picking his way through the rubble surrounding the crystal monolith, Duray glanced up as a sluggish wind moved shattered panes and whistled through cracks high up on the face of the tomb. He saw his reflection in the lower surfaces and remembered hearing the organ song of the evening wind rising from the cleft when he had found the Bikura high on the Pinion Plateau. That seemed like lifetimes ago. It was lifetimes ago. Duray felt the damage the cruciform reconstruction had done to his mind and memory. It was sickening, the equivalent of suffering a stroke with no hope of recovery. reasoning that once would have been child's play to him now required extreme concentration or were simply beyond his ability. Words eluded him. Emotions tugged at him with the same sudden violence as the time tides. Several times he had had to leave the other pilgrims while he wept in solitude for no reason he could understand. The other pilgrims. Now only Saul and the child remained. Father Duray would gladly surrender his own life if those two could be spared. Wasn't it a sin, he wondered, to plan deals with the Antichrist? He was far down the valley now, almost to the point where it curved eastward into the widening cul-de-sac, where the Shrike Palace threw its maze of shadows across the rocks. The trail wound close to the northwest wall as it passed the cave tombs. Duray felt the cool air from the first tomb and was tempted to enter just to recover from the heat, close his eyes, and take a nap. He continued walking. The entrance to the second tomb had more Baroque carvings in the stone, and Duray was reminded of the ancient basilica he had discovered in the cleft, the huge cross and altar where the retarded Bikura had worshipped. It had been the obscene immortality of the cruciform they had been worshipping, not the chance of true resurrection promised by the cross. But what was the difference? Duray shook his head, trying to clear the fog and cynicism that clouded every thought. The path wound higher here, past the third cave tomb, the shortest and least impressive of the three. There was a light in the third cave tomb. Duray stopped, took a breath, and glanced back down the valley. The Sphinx was quite visible, almost a kilometer away, but he could not quite make out Saul in the shadows. For a moment, Duray wondered if it had been the third tomb they had sheltered in the day before, if one of them had left a lantern there. It had not been the third time tomb. Except for the search for Kassad, no one had entered this tomb in 3 days. Father Duray knew that he should ignore the light, return to Saul, keep the vigil with the man and his daughter.
But the Shrike came to each of the others separately. Why should I refuse the summons?
Duray felt moisture on his cheek and realized that he was weeping soundlessly, mindlessly. He roughly wiped the tears away with the back of his hand and stood there clenching his fists.
My intellect was my greatest vanity. I was the intellectual Jesuit, secure in the tradition of Teor and Prasad. Even the theology I pushed on the church, on the seminarians, and on those few faithful still listening, had emphasized the mind, that wonderful omega point of consciousness. God as a clever algorithm. Well, some things are beyond intellect, Paul.
Duray entered the third cave tomb. Saul awoke with a start, sure that someone was creeping up on him. He jumped to his feet and looked around. Rachel was making soft sounds, awakening from her nap at the same time as her father. Braun Lamia lay motionless where he had left her, Med Telltale still glowing green, brain activity readout a flat red. He had slept for at least an hour. The shadows had crept across the valley floor, and only the top of the Sphinx was still in sunlight as the sun broke free of the clouds. Shafts of light slanted through the valley entrance and illuminated the cliff walls opposite. The wind was rising, but nothing moved in the valley. Saul lifted Rachel, rocked her as she cried, and ran down the steps, looking behind the Sphinx and toward the other tombs.
Paul!
His voice echoed off rock. Wind stirred dust beyond the jade tomb, but nothing else stirred. Saul still had the feeling that something was sneaking up on him, that he was being watched. Rachel screamed and wiggled in his grasp, her voice the high, thin wail of a newborn. Saul glanced at his comm log. She would be 1 day old in an hour. He searched the sky for the consul's ship, cursed softly at himself, and went back to the entrance to the Sphinx to change the baby's diaper, check on Braun, pull a nursing pack from his bag, and grab a cloak. The heat dissipated quickly when the sun was gone. In the half hour of twilight remaining, Saul moved quickly down the valley, shouting Duray's name and peering into the tombs without entering. Past the jade tomb where Hoyt had been murdered, its sides already beginning to show a milky green.
past the dark obelisk, its shadow thrown high on the southeastern cliff wall, past the crystal monolith, its upper reaches glowing with the last of the day's light, then fading as the sun set somewhere beyond the city of poets. In the sudden chill and hush of evening, past the cave tombs, Saul shouting into each and feeling the dank air against his face like a cold breath from an open mouth. No answer. In the last of the twilight, around the bend in the valley to the blade and buttress riot of the Shrike Palace, dark and ominous in the growing gloom. Saul stood at the entrance trying to make sense of the ink-black shadows, spires, rafters, and pylons. Shouted into the dark interior, only his echo answered. Rachel began to cry again. Shivering, feeling a chill on the back of his neck, wheeling constantly to surprise the unseen watcher, and seeing only deepening shadows and the first of the night stars between clouds above, Saul hurried back up the valley toward the Sphinx, walking quickly at first, and then almost running past the jade tomb as the evening wind rose with a sound of children screaming.
"God damn!" breathed Saul as he reached the top of the stairs to the Sphinx. Braun Lamia was gone. There was no sign of her body or the metal umbilical. Cursing, holding Rachel tight, Saul fumbled through his pack for the flashlight. 10 meters down the central corridor, Saul found the blanket Braun had been wrapped in. Beyond that, nothing. The corridors branched and twisted, now widening, now narrowing as the ceiling lowered to the point that Saul was crawling, holding the baby in his right arm so that her cheek was next to his. He hated being in this tomb. His heart was pounding so fiercely that he half expected to have a coronary then and there. The last corridor narrowed to nothing. Where the metal cable had snaked into stone, now there was only stone. Saul held the flashlight in his teeth and slapped at the rock, shoved at stones the size of houses, as if a secret panel would open, tunnels would be revealed. Nothing. Saul hugged Rachel tighter and began to make his way out, taking several wrong turns, feeling his heart race even more wildly as he thought himself lost. Then they were in a corridor he recognized, then in the main corridor, then out. He carried his child to the bottom of the steps and away from the Sphinx. At the head of the valley he stopped, sat on a low rock, and panted for breath. Rachel's cheek still lay against his neck, and the baby made no sound, no movement other than the soft curl of fingers against his beard. Wind blew in from the barrens behind him. Clouds opened above and then closed, hiding the stars so that the only light came from the sick glow of the time tombs. Saul was afraid that the wild beating of his heart would frighten the baby, but Rachel continued to curl calmly against him, her warmth a tactile reassurance. "Damn," whispered Saul. He had cared for Braun Lamia. He had cared for all of the pilgrims. And now they were gone. Saul's decades as an academic had preconditioned him to hunt for patterns in events, a moral grain in the accreted stone of experience. But there had been no pattern to events on Hyperion, merely confusion and death. Saul rocked his child and looked out on the barrens, considering leaving this place at once, walking to the dead city or Kronos Keep, walking northwest to the littoral or southeast to where the bridal range intersected the sea. Saul raised a shaky hand to his face and rubbed his cheek. There would be no salvation in the wilderness. Leaving the valley had not saved Martin Silenus. The Shrike had been reported far south of the Bridal Range, as far south as Endymion and the other southern cities. And even if the monster spared them, starvation and thirst would not. Saul might survive on plants, rodent flesh, and snowmelt from the high places, but Rachel's supply of milk was limited, even with the supplies Braun had brought back from the keep. Then he realized that the milk supply did not matter. "I'll be alone in less than a day." Saul stifled a moan as the thought struck him. His determination to save his child had brought him across 2.5 decades and 100 times that many light years.
His resolve to return Rachel's life and health to her was an almost palpable force, a fierce energy which he and Sarai had shared and which he had kept alive the way a temple priest preserves the sacred temple flame. No, by God, there was a pattern to things, a moral underpinning to this platform of seemingly random events, and Saul Weintraub would wager his and his daughter's lives on that belief. Saul stood, walked slowly down the trail to the Sphinx, climbed the stairs, found a therm cloak and blankets, and made a nest for the two of them on the highest step as Hyperion winds howled and the time tombs glowed more brightly. Rachel lay on his chest and stomach, her cheek on his shoulder, her tiny hands curling and uncurling as she released the world for the land of infant sleep. Saul heard her gentle breathing as she moved into deep slumber, heard the soft sound as she blew tiny bubbles of saliva. After a while, he released his own hold on the world and joined her in sleep. 30. Saul dreamed the dream he had suffered since the day Rachel had incurred Merlin's sickness. He was walking through a vast structure, where columns the size of redwood trees rose into the gloom, and where crimson light fell in solid shafts from somewhere far above. There came the sound of a giant conflagration, entire worlds burning. Ahead of him glowed two ovals of the deepest red. Saul knew the place. He knew that he would find an altar ahead with Rachel on it, Rachel in her 20s and unconscious, and then would come the voice, demanding. Saul stopped on the low balcony and stared down at the familiar scene. His daughter, the woman he and Sarai had bid farewell to when she left for postgraduate work on distant Hyperion, lay naked on a broad block of stone. Above them all floated the twin red orbs of the shrike's gaze. On the altar lay a long, curved knife made of sharpened bone. The voice came then.
Saul, take your daughter, your only daughter, Rachel, whom you love, and go to the world called Hyperion, and offer her there as a burnt offering at one of the places of which I shall tell you.
Saul's arms were shaking with rage and grief. He pulled at his hair and shouted into the darkness, repeating what he had told that voice before.
There will be no more offerings, neither child nor parent. There will be no more sacrifices. The time of obedience and atonement is past. Either help us as a friend or go away.
In previous dreams, this had led to the sound of wind and isolation, terrible footsteps receding in the dark. But this time the dream persisted, the altar shimmered and was suddenly empty except for the bone knife. The twin red orbs still floated high above, fire-filled rubies the size of worlds.
"Saul, listen,"
came the voice. Modulated now so it did not boom from far above, but almost whispered in his ear.
The future of humankind depends upon your choice. Can you offer Rachel out of love, if not obedience?
Saul heard the answer in his mind, even as he groped for the words. There would be no more offerings, not this day, not any day. Humankind had suffered enough for its love of gods, its long search for God. He thought of the many centuries in which his people, the Jews, had negotiated with God, complaining, bickering, decrying the unfairness of things, but always, always returning to obedience at whatever the cost. Generations dying in the ovens of hatred. Future generations scarred by the cold fires of radiation and renewed hate. Not this time. Not ever again.
Say yes, Daddy.
Saul started at the touch of a hand on his. His daughter, Rachel, stood next to him. neither infant nor adult, but the 8-year-old he had known twice, aging and growing backward through that age with Merlin's sickness. Rachel, with her light brown hair tied back in a simple braid, short form soft in washed denim play tunic and kid sneakers. Saul took her hand, gripping as tightly as he could without hurting her, feeling the returned grip. This was no illusion, no final cruelty of the shrike. This was his daughter. "Say yes, Daddy." Saul had solved Abraham's problem of obedience to a god turned malicious. Obedience could no longer be paramount in relations between humanity and its deity. But when the child chosen as sacrifice asked for obedience to that god's whim, Saul went to one knee next to his daughter and opened his arms. Rachel. She hugged him with the energy he remembered from countless such hugs, her chin high over his shoulder, her arms fierce in their intensity of love. She whispered in his ear, "Please, Daddy, we have to say yes." Saul continued to hug her, feeling her thin arms around him and the warmth of her cheek against his. He was crying silently, feeling the wetness on his cheeks and in his short beard, but unwilling to release her for even the second it would take to wipe the tears away.
"I love you, Daddy," whispered Rachel. He rose then,
wiped his face with a swipe of the back of his hand, and with Rachel's left hand still firmly in his, began the long descent with her toward the altar below. Saul awoke with a sense of falling, grabbing for the baby. She was asleep on his chest, her fist curled, her thumb in her mouth. But when he started upright, she awoke with the cry and arching reflex of a startled newborn. Saul got to his feet, dropping blankets and cloak around him, clutching Rachel tightly to him. It was daylight, late morning if anything. They had slept while the night died and sunlight crept into the valley and across the tombs. The Sphinx huddled over them like some predatory beast, powerful forelegs extended on either side of the stairway where they had slept. Rachel wailed, her face contorting with the shock of waking and hunger, and sensed fear in her father. Saul stood in the fierce sunlight and rocked her. He went to the top step of the Sphinx, changed her diaper, heated one of the last nursing packs, offered it to her until the wails turned to soft nursing sounds, burped her, and walked her around until she drifted into light sleep again. It was less than 10 hours until her birthday, less than 10 hours until sunset and the last few minutes of his daughter's life. Not for the first time, Saul wished that the Time Tomb were a great glass building, symbolizing the cosmos and the deity that ran it. Saul would throw rocks at this structure until not a single pane remained unbroken. He tried to remember the details of his dream, but the warmth and reassurance of it shredded in the harsh light of Hyperion's sun. He remembered only Rachel's whispered entreaty. The thought of offering her to the shrike made Saul's stomach ache with horror. "It's all right," he whispered to her as she twitched and sighed toward the treacherous haven of sleep once again. "It's all right, kiddo. The consul's ship will be here soon. The ship will come any minute." The consul's ship did not come by noon. The consul's ship did not come by mid-afternoon. Saul walked the valley floor, calling out for those who had disappeared, singing half-forgotten songs when Rachel awoke, crooning lullabies as she drifted back to sleep. His daughter was so tiny and light. 6 pounds and 3 ounces, 19 inches at birth, he remembered, smiling at the antique units of his antique home of Barnard's world. In late afternoon, he startled awake from his half-doze in the shade of the Sphinx's outflung paw, standing with Rachel waking in his arms as a spacecraft arched across the dome of deep lapis sky. "It's come," he cried, and Rachel stirred and wiggled as if in response. A line of blue fusion flame glowed with that daylight intensity reserved to spacecraft and atmosphere. Saul hopped up and down, filled with the first relief in many days. He shouted and leaped until Rachel wailed and wept in concern. Saul stopped, lifted her high, knowing that she could not yet focus her eyes, but wanting her to see the beauty of the descending ship as it arced above the distant mountain range, dropping toward the high desert.
"He did it!" cried Saul. "He's coming! The ship will—"
Three heavy thuds struck the valley almost at once. The first two were the twin sonic booms of the spacecraft's footprint racing ahead of it as it decelerated. The third was the sound of its destruction. Saul stared as the glowing pinpoint at the apex of the long fusion tail suddenly grew as bright as the sun, expanded into a cloud of flame and boiling gases, and then tumbled toward the distant desert in 10,000 burning pieces. He blinked away retinal echoes as Rachel continued crying.
"My God," whispered Saul. "My God."
There was no denying the complete destruction of the spacecraft. Secondary explosions ripped the air, even from 30 kilometers away, as pieces fell, trailing smoke and flames, toward the desert, the mountains, and the sea of grass beyond.
"My God."
Saul sat on the warm sand. He was too exhausted to cry, too empty to do anything but rock his child until her crying stopped. 10 minutes later, Saul looked up as two more fusion trails burned the sky, these headed south from the zenith. One of these exploded, too distant for sound to reach him. The second one dropped out of sight below the southern cliffs beyond the bridal range.
"Perhaps it was not the consul," whispered Saul. "It could be the Auster invasion. Perhaps the consul's ship still will come for us."
But the ship did not come by late afternoon. It had not come by the time the light of Hyperion's small sun shone on the cliff wall, shadows reaching for Saul on the highest step of the Sphinx. It did not come when the valley fell in shadow. Rachel was born less than 30 minutes from this second. Saul checked her diaper, found her dry, and fed her from the last nursing pack. As she ate, she looked up at him, with great, dark eyes, seemingly searching his face. Saul remembered the first few minutes he had held her, while Sarai rested under warmed blankets. The baby's eyes had burned into him then with these same questions and startlement at finding such a world. The evening wind brought clouds moving in quickly above the valley. Rumbles to the southwest came first as distant thunder, and then with the sick regularity of artillery, most likely nuclear or plasma explosions 500 clicks or more to the south. Saul scanned the sky between lowering clouds and caught glimpses of fiery meteor trails arching overhead, ballistic missiles or dropships probably. Death for Hyperion in either case. Saul ignored it. He sang softly to Rachel as she finished nursing. He had walked to the head of the valley, but now he returned slowly to the Sphinx. The tombs were glowing as never before, rippling with the harsh light of neon gases excited by electrons. Overhead, the last shafts from the setting sun changed the low clouds to a ceiling of pastel flames. Less than 3 minutes remained until the final celebration of Rachel's birth. Even if the consul's ship arrived now, Saul knew that he would not have time to board it or get his child into cryogenic sleep. He did not want to. Saul climbed the stairs to the Sphinx slowly, realizing that Rachel had come this way 26 standard years earlier, never guessing the fate that awaited her in that dark crypt. He paused at the top step and took in a breath. The light from the sun was a palpable thing, filling the sky and igniting the wings and upper mass of the Sphinx. The tomb itself seemed to be releasing the light it had stored, like the rocks in Hebron's desert, where Saul had wandered in the wilderness years before, seeking enlightenment and finding only sorrow. The air shimmered with light, and the wind continued to rise, blowing sand across the valley floor and then relenting. Saul went to one knee on the top step, pulling off Rachel's blanket, until the child was in only her soft cotton newborn's clothes, swaddling clothes. Rachel wiggled in his hands. Her face was purple and slick,
her hands tiny and red with the effort of clenching and unclenching. Saul remembered her exactly like this, as the doctor handed the infant to Saul, as he stared at his newborn daughter, as he was staring now, then set her on Sarai's stomach so the mother could see. "Ah, God," breathed Saul, and dropped to his other knee, truly kneeling now.